Welcome to Dose Nation Aftermath, Episode 3. I am James Kent, and I am joined again by my co-hosts, psychedelic community organizer Hilla.
Hey.
And psychedelic enthusiast Ty Miller.
Hey, everybody.
We talked a little bit about how each of you were introduced to psychedelics, and I'm guessing that neither one of you had much of a scientific background before taking psychedelics for the first time. High school biology.
Yeah, high school biology, maybe high school chemistry.
Yeah. High school education, I guess. Some like environmental health, I guess. Background there, I guess.
But nothing about neuroscience or psychology or anything like that. So because psychedelics produce such unique effects, they're often described in religious, spiritual, or psychological metaphors. And because of this conflation, psychedelic experience comes its own kind of unique philosophy, mixing all of these different metaphors from many spiritual, occult, and shamanic traditions. Would we agree that that's essentially where the psychedelic community is today?
Yes.
Right? It's become its own philosophy. Psychedelics have become their own sort of cross between spirituality and magic and psychology and medicine. Mm-hmm. They're their own thing now.
Without a doubt. I would even say there's almost the guru. I mean, we've talked about this already, but the guru culture around psychedelics, where there's pockets of communities brewing up around ayahuasca shaman, basically.
Okay, so my main motivation for doing this episode is because when I got into psychedelics, I didn't have any scientific knowledge. And I had no idea what was going on in the experience. And that was sort of my entree into wanting to study psychedelics, is to figure out what was going on, how my own mind could actually do this. My point is that if you lack the basic scientific knowledge to view the psychedelic experience in terms of pharmacology or biological effects, you're necessarily limited to viewing the experience through an abstracted metaphorical frame. So the question is, are the spiritual, religious, or even psychological metaphors that the psychedelic community has adopted actually helpful to people, or do they place the experience in an overly dramatic frame? Discuss. Hella, what about you? You study psychology. I'm guessing you use a lot of metaphors in psychology to talk about people's trauma or healing or...
Yeah, you know, I'm personally less interested in metaphor, unless it's just very direct and personal. And I think that that is largely the issue you're pointing at a bit, is making it impersonal. Like, what's going on outside of me? What is the story outside of me? And shouldn't the question be more about, you know, how is this story useful to me, or how do I identify with this story or this metaphor or whatever it is?
So you're talking about metaphors that may relate to your personal life.
Yeah.
As opposed to metaphors about God and death and,
yeah.
and
yeah.
the afterlife. What about you, Ty? You're over here listening very intently.
I don't, you know, it's interesting because if I'm honest with it, I really didn't get involved in psychedelics until my 30s. I flirted with it in my 20s, but nothing substantial. And probably read Terence McKenna beforehand. So I had kind of that framework going into the experience. And I think that that probably colored it. However, I think I'm really skeptical. So I was able to scrutinize the experience, but I just don't think that many people are able to. And what happens is they come to believe whatever narrative they're fed. And I think that the narrative itself, on some level, people adopt some sort of narrative. They're getting it from somewhere, but whoever's generating that narrative, right, is essentially, you know, steering,
lying to people.
Yeah, lying to people. So I think as we get deeper into the notes for this podcast, I'll have more to say about it. But at this point in time, I'm pretty against symbolism. I'm against metaphor. You know, I think if you're going to get something from the experience, it has to be your experience, and to try to equate it to other people's experience is probably fruitless. Mm-hmm. Because you're just trying to satisfy the whims of the person that planted the fruit, if you will.
Right. So there's this thing that I think I see happening in the psychedelic community, is that somebody will say, a writer or a speaker or somebody on a podcast will say, I had an experience where this happened. And it can be either, you know, crossing a bridge of life and death, or seeing myself in the future.
Machine elves.
Right, machine elves, anything fantastical. And somebody hears that and says, hey, I want that experience. Mm. I want to replicate what this other person did because I want to feel that thing too. That sounds cool. So there's this game of telephone happening with the psychedelic experience where they say, oh, so-and-so had a, you know, a heroic journey through the battle of good and evil. That sounds fun. I want to try that too. And then their heroic journey becomes this mutated version of whatever's going on in their own psyche. And then they say, oh, yes, well, I did have a heroic journey. I mean, it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So let's clear this up, because if I'm not mistaken, and I'm sure a lot of people will let me know that I am, right? But if I'm not mistaken, that term comes from Terrence McKenna, who suggested a heroic dose, which was 5 dried grams of...
It's actually from Joseph Campbell, you know, the hero.
I have no qualms with that. I totally agree that Joseph Campbell, the hero with 1,000 faces, right, came up with the hero's journey, right? But I believe that it's Joe Rogan that started to call the psychedelic... like the 5 gram journey, the hero's journey.
He calls it the hero's journey.
Yeah, because Terrence McKenna, I don't think ever referred to it. He called it a heroic dose, but yeah. I don't think he ever referred to it as going on the hero's journey.
There were other people in the psychedelic community using that metaphor, though.
Okay,
there are people who have written books about that. I can't.
Okay, my mistake. So just real quickly, what I wanted to say though too is what I experienced too was a lot of I guess FOMO, fear of missing out, because I would hear people talk about riding tigers or riding panthers through the jungle and all this type of thing on ayahuasca, and like all that ever happened to me was I was attacked by like giant tentacles, you know. Giant tentacles made out of like...
I don't even get tentacles.
You have to escape the tentacles before you get to ride the tiger. I mean, that's part of it.
Well, the thing is I would hear these people talking about these like fantastic journeys, and I would literally get jealous to a point. Now I don't. Now I kind of got past it, because I just feel like, you know, if you're getting caught up in the visions...
It's not the light show, man.
It's not the light show. So it's like I would prefer, I think, to just honestly wrestle with my own thoughts, as Hilla just pointed out.
So Hilla, do you ever have any spiritual symbology or stuff happening in any of your psychedelic sessions? Any god or angels or demons or anything like that?
Not once. Not once. I've had that experience of hearing about it a lot of times, hearing about the puma riding and maybe feeling like, wow. It leaves me feeling a little bit like, honestly, a little judgmental. So like, why are you like, you know, talking to a unicorn or something like this when I'm like, you know, thinking about my mom or like my relationship issue or something like that? But that's largely what.
So it's very, it's much more interpersonal than fantastical.
Yeah. I mean, I'm generally, I think that psychedelics have made me not interested in fantasy. Honestly, when I started eating them, I think I was more interested in fantasy, but hasn't really landed on me that way.
Huh. I blame James for that, because
because I'm a buzzkill.
Dream killer.
I was interested in, I wanted to subscribe. I want to be a shaman. Let's face facts, you know? I want a bunch of groupies.
No, you don't want to be a shaman. You want to be a guru.
Fair enough.
Yeah, you want to have like a whole harem around you.
Fair enough. Yeah. But then, you know, stumbling upon the, actually a friend of mine recommended the first 10 podcasts, and it was a clarion call, basically. It was a very sobering.
You're talking about the final 10 episodes.
The final 10 episodes.
The dark side, yeah.
Yeah, it was a very sobering, you know, and it was so needed to take that kind of look at the community, you know, and I think, honestly, I think that more people ought to.
One of the things that that really got under my skin that I wanted to talk about when I did the first 10 episodes, and I mentioned this, I think, maybe in the first or second episode, was that back in the day with the Harvard gang, with Leary and Richard Alpert and Ralph Metzner, they thought the best thing in the world would be to translate the Tibetan Book of the Dead and create this metaphor of psychedelics as a near-death experience or a crossover experience. And they sold that experience to a generation of people who then would take acid and believe that they were dying, because the seed of this Tibetan Book of the Dead was planted in their head. In retrospect, was that a good idea? And what were these guys thinking?
I don't know. I feel like I see it everywhere in the psychedelic community, but these kinds of experiences that are dopamine fueled, that are exciting, that are, I'm going to figure it all out. Like, I'm figuring it out. It being something outside of the person. There's not anything more dangerous than trying to figure it out. It just creates all these weird stories that only apply to a certain group of people and then end up excluding people and then end up with some crazy idea that doesn't actually have any gift for a greater population.
Sure. So I guess the question is, are all of these spiritual frames helpful, or do they create potential pitfalls that could cause people to get into these dramatic inner conflicts about being saved or being damned?
Without knowing that it's a story and it's the purpose is to use it as a story to identify with pieces of a story, then I think it is damaging.
Well, it just occurred to me while we were discussing this too, that largely most people that I know in the psychedelic community are fairly anti-religious. Right.
But they're spiritual.
Well, but they take their spirituality as a religion, you know, whatever, you know what I mean? Like, just this idea that grandmother ayahuasca is an entity that you communicate and somehow I'm able to communicate more effectively with her than you are. That's why I'm pouring the medicine. I mean, this is a religion, right? Let's face facts, right? You're a devotee at that point in time. You know, you've drunk the Kool-Aid. But I think, always defend Tim Leary and the Harvard gang just because they didn't know any better. Nobody knew what they were doing.
Yeah,
right?
Fair enough.
Well, nobody knew.
That's sort of my point. It's like they knew that these were powerful drugs, but they didn't really know what they were doing when they unleashed this thing on the public.
if no one knew what it was, if no one knew what it was, and then the three of us were like dropping acid in your basement, right? We would be like, let's write. Just in case anyone was wondering, James actually has authored a book called Psychedelic
That's
Information
right.
Theory. It is available on his website.
It's available at Amazon. You could probably find a free copy of it, or you know, if you want to throw me some cash, you can buy the hard copy from Amazon.
Buy a book and read it.
Amazon.com. There's pretty pictures in there.
Yeah, that's true.
I have a copy that I bought on Amazon, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the only place you can get it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. If you'd like to support this podcast, you could buy a copy of Psychedelic Information Theory on Amazon.com, or download a copy of Radio Free Mars, an original science fiction novel by James Kent. Available for free on Kindle Unlimited from Amazon.com. Just search for Radio Free Mars or Psychedelic Information Theory by James Kent.
I have a feeling that when they wrote the Tibetan Book of the Dead, there were still people who were seriously considering that psychedelics may be a way of crossing the boundary of life and death and exploring the afterlife, if there was such a thing. Yes or no?
I think there's people that still believe it right now.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about when we, you know, we all have this context. Like, what is a drug? What do drugs do?
Right.
They're still drugs. They're changing consciousness, changing your perception, changing how you think or whatever it is. And maybe like that idea wasn't, I mean, that's in the forefront of my mind when we're talking about psychedelics. They're drugs. So maybe that just wasn't, you know, it seems silly to think this will make it so I could cross over into the realm of the dead temporarily and then still be alive at the end of the day. But because I have the context of this as a drug.
Right.
And maybe that just wasn't so much.
So Hilla says she hasn't really had many.
I wouldn't say not spiritual, just
well,
not like
gods and demons or symbolic archetypes.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And what about you? Have you seen?
Well, I've said this before, and I'll say it again, just because it's such an important point. Like, I would be so fucking pissed off if I was tripping and I saw Jesus. That would be the last trip I ever had. I would just be so fucking angry. I'd just be like, "What in the fuck has happened?" Right? And
he was like, "Dude, let's hang out."
Well, maybe then if he was wearing like Birkenstocks, had a
cool
hacky sack
say.
And stuff, right?
So we don't maybe fall into this category of people who have these experiences, but what about people who do?
Well, so this is the point that I'm trying to make, and it's not that I'm anti-religious, which I mean, really? to be honest, I am. But at the end of the day, the point that I'm trying to make, right? At the point that I'm trying to make is that I would have the same reaction, the same visceral experience if, like, I was tripping balls and, like, Joe Montana came to me, like a famous football player, right? It would just frustrate to me to no end that somehow the culture had permeated my mm-hmm. conscious experience mm-hmm. to such a degree that now it was yeah. influencing my private
okay,
thoughts.
Yeah. But there again, you have the presence of mind to think, oh, these are just manifestations of my psyche. These aren't actual entities with their own agency that are coming to visit me, because there's some sort of magnetic field that emanates from you when you're high that attracts ghosts and spirits, right? I mean, I've heard this before, right? Sure, this is the thing. You take the drugs and suddenly you start vibrating and spirits can smell you and they're on
come
your...
say what's up.
So you always had the presence of mind to realize that anything that you manifested was basically of your own psyche.
You know, for a while in ayahuasca circles, I was pretty seduced by the whatever you want to call it. I bought into it for a while, but over time, now I'm 100% like, this is just whatever is going on in my mind. I really like to think that there's spirit entities and stuff like this, but I'm not 100% sure why taking a psychedelic would reveal them to us, and when the psychedelic wears off, they seem to go away, which is kind of confusing, I think, anyways.
Does seeing an archetype in a psychedelic trip somehow make that trip more precious or important to the person who experiences it?
It seems like it does for a lot of people.
Hillary just can't even. The look on her face over here is just like, oh no.
I just don't know why. I guess just to talk about myself, I like the idea of psychedelics changing consciousness in a way that is tuning my radio to receive some information that's there all the time that now I can pick up because I'm high. That's cool. That sounds cool.
Right.
You know, then I, you know, like have some other information, or there's, you know, like the cosmic circuit board over everything when I'm looking around with my eyes open and closed. That's cool. Maybe it's there all the time.
Wait, tell us again about this cosmic
circuit. Oh, the cosmic circuit board. Yeah. That's the, you know, like the zzz over everything. It's like,
gotcha.
I don't have like a lot of visionary visions, but I do see like, you know, stuff.
Great. I'm going to have to remember that one.
So, but whatever about that, I think that the reason that I'm not into that antenna idea so much is because it doesn't do anything for me. Like, I just don't get a lot out of that. So it pains me that people see Jesus Christ, ride pumas, Mayan, whoever see entities, and I just don't know what that is doing for them in their daily waking life to make them an actual better person or a more functional person or a more kind person or
right.
more ecologically friendly person.
So the one thing that stands out to me, in order to see, and this is important, this is an important point, in order to see the Mayan calendar, in order to see Jesus, in order to see a jaguar, you have to know what they are ahead of time, otherwise you wouldn't recognize them, right? So what I'm arguing for is there's some sort of pre-programming.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is we're going to talk about this in the next segment a little bit. What are archetypes? And is it possible for someone to spontaneously flash on an archetype in their head if they've never been exposed to that archetype in their life? You're saying no.
No, I'm saying impossible. No. I'll say no, yeah.
You'll say flat no. Now, there are people who believe in like a collective unconscious or a dream space out there where these archetypes exist, and they become accessible to people when they are in altered states. How does that gel with you, Hilla?
Just when I hear those kinds of things, I'm always skeptical and I think, oh, you had to have seen this, or you had to have been exposed to this idea in your long life somewhere,
right.
TV, the internet, you know, having a conversation. For myself, I've had a couple experiences where I was introduced to something while I was high, introduced via my own consciousness.
Right.
I was like, what the fuck was that? And I just think I don't read into it too much, because I just think I must have been exposed to that at some point.
So we're talking about a collective ideology of some kind. If you mm-hmm. came across something that you'd never thought of before, mm-hmm. that's different mm-hmm. than an archetype, right?
Right.
Yeah. So it's like, I could totally see tripping balls and all of a sudden you come up with this whole you know, your own personal mythology that you could make pretty elaborate, right?
Sure, yeah.
But we're talking about like an established archetype, like tripping balls and seeing Archangel Gabriel. You know, it's a very concrete imagery, right?
Sure. But there's this other thing that I read with people, or I've heard people say in trips, that they'll see faces. They'll see like a face of a shaman or a face of a Native American woman or a face of... And they'll say, but, and it's people that I've never met before. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing faces I've never seen. Therefore, I must be tapping into something. How could I be seeing faces I've never seen before?
I mean, that's my one experience with that, is seeing this Peruvian grandma lady when I was high on ayahuasca. And I thought it was really cool. But I also, you know.
I have a confession. Don't. It's been me all along. Like, I've been in sweat lodges or whatever and hallucinated seeing medicine men, you know, but it kind of, the milieu lends itself to something like that.
Right. You're almost programmed to see that.
It's like, if you go to a horror movie, you're probably more likely to think that it's scary. Like, if you went to a horror movie and you had no conception that it was supposed to be scary, as strange as this may sound, like if you have no conception that it's supposed to be scary and then you go into it, you're not going to have that kind of on the edge of your seat, like, oh, I'm about to get scared, you know? Huh.
So you might think it's funny when those people get killed.
Yeah, like the chainsaw cutting people's faces off. James, is that what you're talking about?
Oh boy, you know, we're like teeing up all the stuff for the next segment here. Did you have a final thought for this segment here?
I do think that it pains me to say this a bit, but it does seem like there's something to this collective conscious thing. There's something, because we have these symbols. And do we have these, and mostly for my mind, we have the symbols that repeat, and again, I'm not into symbols, I don't care. But I have observed, mostly in people who have these dopamine-fueled investigations, that through different cultures, there are a lot of the same symbols. And so I think that we can rely somewhat on those symbols as stories to connect us to cultural stories and cultural constructs. So there's something representative there to learn about our own experience, but not so much as an existing idea outside of ourselves.
I don't think that's completely far-fetched. If you look at, and I'm no expert in this, I'm going to get a lot of flack for this, but I'm going to say it anyway, surprise, surprise. If you look at like Chomsky's universal grammar, right? Essentially something, there's elements of every language that exists that are similar to every other language that exists, right? So there could be something inherent in the structure of the brain.
Something biological. That lends itself to these symbols repeating.
Precisely, right? Because if you've taken psychedelics, you can say this to anyone else that has taken psychedelics. You can say, I knew it was coming on because I looked at the carpet and it was doing that thing. And everybody that's ever eaten a psychedelic will be like, I know what you're talking about.
It's like, it's like waving like a field of grain in the wind.
Yeah. You know? So that has to be a biological thing where whatever the drug is that you're taking is interacting with the physical structure of the brain, whatever it is. I mean, it's just undeniable because that is a universal experience. I've never encountered one person that would be like, what are you talking about?
You know? Live podcast of the Cascadia Psychedelic Conference is going on, Town Hall.
What's the dates?
April 10, 11, 12.
April 10, 11, 12. And you've got some speakers up on your website at CascadiaPsychedelic.org. I noticed my picture's not up there yet. Am I not speaking?
No, we don't. Yeah.
Should I send you something? Will you put me up?
Yeah, if you want to.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going
to
have a
Do you want me to do a presentation besides the podcast, or just do the podcast?
Do you want to?
I could.
I think we could probably get you in there, man.
Okay.
I think I could probably talk to some people.
Do you know the organizer?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. What do you want to talk about?
Can you put my picture up too?
Yeah, if you want.
I'm just kidding. Why don't you put my picture up?
Because your hair is so good.
That's right. We're planning a live Dose Nation podcast recording at the Cascadia Psychedelic Conference at Town Hall in Seattle on April 10th through 12th, 2020. For more information, visit CascadiaPsychedelic.com. That's CascadiaPsychedelic.com.
Is there any one case that you can now look back on and feel that perhaps it was the turning point of your thought?
Oh, yes. And I can tell you an example. We had a patient in the ward. He was quiet, but completely dissociated, schizophrenic. And he was in the clinic already for over 20 years. He had come into the clinic, as a matter of fact, being a young man, and did no particular education. And once I came to the ward, and he was obviously excited and called to me, took me by the lapel of my coat and led me to the window and said, "Doctor, now you must see. Now look at it. Look up at the sun and see how it moves. You see, you must move your head too like this. And then you will see the, you know, that's the origin of the wind. And you see how the sun moves as you move your head from one side to the other." Now, of course, I didn't understand it at all. I thought, oh, there you are, he's just crazy. But that case remained in my mind. And 4 years later, I came across a paper written by the German historian Edith Dietrich, who had dealt with the so-called Mithras liturgy, a part of the great Parisian sorcerer papyrus. And there he produced the a part of the so-called Mithras liturgy. Namely, it is said there, "After the second prayer, thou wilt see how the disk of the sun unfolds. And you will see hanging down from it the tube, the origin of the wind. And when you move thy face to the regions of the east, it will move there. And if you move your face to the region of the west, it will follow you." And instantly, I know, and you, now, this is it. This is the vision of my patient.
But how could you be sure that your patient wasn't unconsciously recalling something that somebody had told him?
Oh, no, quite out of question, because that thing was not known. It was in a magic papyrus in Paris, and it wasn't even published. It was only published 4 years later after I had observed it with my patient.
And this, you felt, proved that there was an unconscious, which was something more than personal.
Oh, well, that was not a proof to me, but it was a hint. And I took the hint.
Now, tell me.
There we have Carl Jung giving the story about how a schizophrenic patient, had a vision with the sun, about moving his head and the sun would follow the direction, and this is the origin of the wind. It's sort of a weird prayer. And then he sees this prayer 4 years later in a magical manuscript that's basically from ancient Greece, the Mithras liturgy, where the prayer is repeated, or something, a facsimile of the prayer is repeated. And Carl Jung assumes there's a connection between the patient and the Mithras liturgy. Can either of you here tell me what the connection between the patient and the Mithras liturgy is?
Carl Jung is the connection.
That's right. Exactly. You got it. Carl Jung is the only thing that binds these two pieces of information together, right? So Carl Jung is the collective unconsciousness.
I agree. In this instance, I couldn't agree more. I mean, are you really telling me that someone is incapable on their own of coming up with this elaborate mythology that the wind comes from the sun, and if you look to the west, the wind is going to go to the west, and if you look to the east, the wind will go to the east? I have a suspicion that I could have come up with that.
So you believe it's coincidence?
In this instance, yes. I mean, come on.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff like this that people tell me about. And I always have to say, it's got to be coincidence. Either that, or there is some little magical rabbit hole that schizophrenics can access to get material from the Greek mysteries.
I mean, I would argue
something better.
I would argue in this case, right? In this case, if what Jung was saying, right, it would be a common metaphor. This is not a common metaphor. It's rather it's rather uncommon. Like, mm-hmm. I don't recall Hilla ever talking about this, right? Nor you, James.
Well, I mean, that could bolster the opinion that there has to be a connection because it is so uncommon.
No, the point that I'm making is if a collective unconscious, right, would suggest that we all have access to this. And what I'm saying is that if it was truly a collective metaphor, then it would be accessed more often, not less often.
The interviewer would even have more context for what he's saying.
You are exactly. Gotcha. That's the point that I'm making, right? So the fact that it is such a unique instance, I think, argues against Jung's point. And I mean, I'm not overly familiar with Jung, but the rarity of the event doesn't lend credence to the overall collective nature of the argument. That's my point.
So is Carl Jung barking up the wrong tree going down this line of thinking?
So no,
I'm gonna let Hilla answer here because she's got it.
Oh, I just feel sad to think about him barking up the wrong tree. But this, I mean,
he wouldn't be the first psychiatrist to get a crazy idea.
Yeah, that's, I mean, especially for the time. Yes, it's, half of his ideas are good and half are totally wacky. I don't find, unless you're using, and this is my theme of the day, unless you're using it for something about bettering yourself, I just don't find it terribly interesting. Why spend so much time connecting dots that don't actually ultimately have any meaning? Because you're not giving them any meaning. The person isn't giving them any meaning.
Right.
There's nothing there otherwise.
And I'll just add real quickly too, because I'll make the same point for Jung that I made earlier on for Leary and Alpert, right? They just didn't know any better. Right. They're essentially creating a new field. And you know, he was doing what he could with the tools that he had. I just think that we've advanced beyond that at this point in time.
That's all good and well. But when people today are exposed to psychedelics and they don't know what's going on, who are the first places they go to? They go to Terence McKenna. They go to Tim Leary. They go to Carl Jung. They don't go to crack open a neuroscience textbook. They go wade into this sort of symbolic world of magic and the occult and alchemy and mysticism, thinking that these may have more answers and like lead to a road or a path to understanding that will put all the pieces together for them. But my question is, does following alchemy or the occult ultimately lead anybody to any deeper understanding of anything?
I don't think so.
Or is it just entertainment?
Well, I mean, I
certainly studied alchemy for a little bit of when I was alchemy in the occult, when I was first studying psychedelics, before I actually got into studying science. I studied mysticism pretty intently. And, you know, after 4 or 5 years of studying the occult and alchemy, I was like, I don't understand any of this. I don't even know what this is, what you're supposed to do with all of this. And it was kind of at that point that I realized that there is no understanding here. It's just a lot of stuff to memorize, rituals, symbols, you know, texts.
Like astrology?
Yeah, exactly. You could put astrology in that. Is there like an inside joke here? Or is someone following an astrologist?
I just think when you listen to an astrologer, if they're any good, they sound like literally a schizophrenic, like a paranoid schizophrenic. Just like bringing together the most disparate references possible. And I'm just always amazed. I'm just people believe you?
Oh, I've heard some pretty good astrology. Like cool, like stories and all that. And I think that that's what is good about it. I don't read my horoscope. I don't care. But if a person can use a story about stars and planets and, you know, deities or whatever it is, ancient stories, and make meaning of their life, that's cool.
I agree, and this is actually kind of a point that I jotted down is when you start asking if the occult is useful or if astrology is useful, you know, the next logical thing is religion useful? And I think it is for some people. I think some people, you know, get a great deal out of all these things, right?
Well, religion is definitely a system of, I mean, political and social control. I mean, that's the use. That's why religion was invented, essentially.
You know, I'm talking more from an individual point of view, right? And I'm not going to argue if it's for control or not. I mean, probably devices for controlling populations. But I know religious people that have gotten a lot out of their religion. I know astrologers that, you know, cling to their astrology and it brings joy and happiness to their life. And in these ways, I think that they're valuable tools. That's kind of the point that I'm making.
Yeah.
So can we equate astrology and the cult to something like Star Wars? or the Marvel Universe, where people view those mythic archetypes as more personal to them than, say, demons or angels.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's somebody out there that's been tripping and saw Captain Kirk giving orders on the bridge.
For sure. For sure. No doubt. Yeah.
The Klingons are coming.
If archetypes change with every generation or with every culture, is there any worth in going back and digging through the archetypes of a previous century and trying to find some sort of connection there?
If those stories are cool to you, you know, every once in a while I hear some, you know, like old myth and think like, wow, oh, that's really neat. Ah, I can see like how this situation in my life is relating to this character, and that's cool. And oh, I was kind of, you know, maybe that character has some exacerbated behavior, and I could see like, oh, that's something that I might do if I got really angry or something, you know, like in that way, I think it's useful because the stories are creative. It's like why we like Shakespeare. But otherwise.
But there's this other thing about people that you mentioned before, people who get obsessed with figuring it all out, right?
Yes.
People who get obsessed with figuring it all out. Mm-hmm. Does anybody who goes and studies all of this stuff, they ever figure anything out?
There's nothing to figure out, man.
So I'll argue this too. You know, there's only so many stories of her. Human perseverance. There's only so many human stories, right? There's the love story. There's the, you know, the father dies and I have to fend for myself story or whatever, right? The point that I'm saying is that previous cultures or modern cultures, it appears that they're recapitulating old stories, but they're not. They're just telling the same story in a new way. You know, the metaphor that comes to my mind is, you know, I just recently saw a Shakespeare play where they were wearing modern clothes, right? So in this way, it's literally redressing an older story, right? Mm-hmm. Now, does this mean that there's a similarity between the old story and the modern story, or is it actually the same story? And I would argue, I think that it's the same story. Like human dilemmas haven't changed that much. That, you know, in probably what, maybe 1,000 years, maybe 2,000 years, human dilemmas haven't changed that
right.
much.
Human drama is always human drama.
Precisely. And to say that if a love story like Romeo and Juliet, I mean, it's just so classic, and it'll be played out again and again and again and again. It's just, and it was probably, I mean, where did Shakespeare even get the idea from it? He probably saw something in reality that he based it on. So it's if Shakespeare was a guy, blah 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 blah. But like the whole point being that nothing frustrates me more than people that cite ancient wisdom as somehow being more valid than modern wisdom. You know, oh, the ancients said this, therefore, because they were in contact with the aliens, they knew more than we could possibly know now because we're no longer in contact with the aliens. I mean, give me a break. It has to end at some point in time. Like the ancients, sure, they had sophisticated calendars, but they didn't have a calendar on their fucking iPhone, you know?
Yeah. So, Hilla, if what I hear you saying, you can go back and search through all of these archetypes and symbols and metaphors or whatever, but if they don't ultimately lead back to the self, they're essentially useless. They're frivolous.
That's my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Ty, would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you listen to a good mythologist or a good storyteller, one of the very first things that they're going to tell you is when you hear this story, you know, find yourself in it, you know, identify yourself in it. You know, what can you take from it? Don't worry about what the story is about. How does the story affect you, or what do you see about yourself in that story? So it's rendering some sort of external experience internal, then you're essentially giving the experience away to whatever's providing it.
Okay, well, we're going to come back with a story from a listener that wrote me recently, and let's see if we can find ourselves in this story. We'll be right back after this short break.
Shakespeare in modern clothes.
Was it one, like before or after?
Like literally 1 minute before you said Shakespeare, and I was like, you fucking stole my idea.
I didn't see it though. Did you see me see it?
I wasn't paying attention. I like to think I saw something.
Although we offer advice on this show, we are not therapists. The advice we offer is based solely on our personal experience and for entertainment value only. If you've had a difficult psychedelic experience and need help with recovery, you can start by looking for a therapist in your area at integration.maps.org. If you need help finding a therapist or a psychedelic support group in your area, or want to share your psychedelic experience with us, feel free to reach out at contact@dosenation.com. That's contact@dosenation.com. This week we have a very long essay from a listener who had some very challenging experiences on mushrooms at a time in their life when they were studying Gnosticism and the origins of Christian archetypes. Warning signs, anyone? Okay. This is a long wind-up, so we're going to have to take a few breaks here, but let's start. Subject, to James Kent, psychotic break. James, thank you so much for responding to my email and giving me this opportunity to tell you how much your last 10 episodes of Dose Nation impacted me and for the chance to tell you my story. I discovered your podcast by a Google search of psychedelics and suicide. I recently had my first bad trip. It wasn't what some would call challenging. This was a full-blown, horrific psychotic break. But I wasn't sure enough to call it this until I listened to your show. My relationship with psychedelics only started about a year ago and I have tripped less than 10 times. I'm 31 years old. I live in a small 5,000-person town in south-central Illinois where I spent most of my life, and I work for a local government agency. Up until this past February, I was a boilermaker. I worked in different coal-fired power plants all over the place for a living, and before that, I was a combat engineer in the Marines for 4 years. I was one of the guys walking around with a metal detector looking for bombs. Forgive me again for all the details, but I want you to be aware of the type of person I am. I come from a lower-middle-class family, which is much of the demographic here. While growing up, my father was a Baptist preacher at a very small church. He didn't bring home much money, so my mother was the breadwinner. She made ends meet by working in a headlight factory and doing seamstress work on the side. Like I said, my father was a Baptist preacher, and I was very devout for quite some time. My dad was a great preacher. The congregation adored him. I saw how the church members watched him and believed every word he said. But I saw something different. You see, my father didn't practice what he preached. When we got home, I was in constant fear of my father. I never knew when he was going to snap at me for looking at him the wrong way or waking him up while he was napping in the recliner, and I walked across the house to get something from the kitchen. These small things were grounds for verbal and physical abuse. He constantly cheated on my mother, and I'm pretty sure he may have molested my sisters, his two daughters. Long story short, I confronted my dad about it all and told him if I ever found out he was up to that kind of shit in any way, shape, or form, then I would bury him. Soon after, my mother and he divorced, and I basically had zero relationship with him. Pretty good starting point for psychedelic exploration.
Trauma!
So this is Middle America, right? I mean, this is not an uncommon story for Middle America. This is just the way things are, and so...
Sadly, we say this is just the way things are when there's like a horrendous family situation.
Well, what I'm saying is this isn't uncommon. Sure, I mean, this is split family and abusive father, and usually there's alcohol and drugs involved as well. Mm-hmm, but okay, continuing. Up until this point, I was still a Christian. I was the singer of a praise band. I played guitar and sang every morning. I guess it would have been several months before finding out about my father's sinister acts. This is when I started having a lot of doubts. I must have read the Bible 3 times or so by age 24, but I guess I didn't actually think about it when I read it. When I decided to open my Bible up again and read the words literally, none of it made sense to me. The Old Testament was riddled with contradictions and absurdities, not to mention atrocities and murder, all at the will of the Almighty. Months went on, and I spoke to preachers, church elders, and even got into Facebook groups about questions about the Bible, and all roads led to nowhere. The most disturbing thing wasn't that people didn't have the answers. It was that they didn't want to hear the questions, or they would just say things like, God can do whatever he wants because he's God. Stupid shit like that, which lacked any kind of intellectual exercise, so they could still be secure in their religion. In my studies of the Bible and my research on the internet to find answers, I came across something called Gnosticism. I suspect you have an idea of what Gnosticism is, since Terence McKenna talked about it, and it's intertwined in psychedelic and New Age culture. But to recap, the basic idea is that God the Creator is actually a lesser God, who created us for the sole purpose of worshiping him. And the serpent in the garden was sent by the universal unknowable God to give us the light or knowledge to wake us up. It is said that man has the divine spark of the true God, but we are trapped in this reality by a lesser god, Yahweh or Yaldabaoth. Yaldabaoth. Talk about... Yaldabaoth. Now, have any of you studied Gnosticism or heard this particular... this line before?
Yeah, I've heard it called the Demiurge, though. Does that sound familiar?
Maybe.
No.
It's no. This is when we start talking about naming gods and demons and stuff, that's when my eyes start to glaze over and I'm like, oh boy. Okay. Talk about the biggest conspiracy theory ever. Forget Illuminati or the moon landing or any of that shit. These Gnostics were the OG conspiracy theorists.
Love that.
What's worse than thinking that good and evil are at odds for your soul? How about thinking that the good guys are actually the bad guys, and the main bad guy is actually one of the good guys? So everything you've ever believed up until this point is one great big fucking lie. Now,
meme.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying I believe or believed any of this per se, but I found it addictively interesting and would continue to learn about Gnosticism as well about every conspiracy theory imaginable. I completely lost my faith and was pretty much a militant atheist. I kept digging into religious history and kept begging the question, why are people inherently religious? Good question. I think it's a good question.
I had to think about that for a while. I don't think I agree with that.
Are they
at
inherently
all.
Religious, no. Or do we need to be taught religion?
I honestly think that religion is appeal to authority complex, and I think that people are inherently authoritative. And in other words, like there's a patriarchy, a matriarchy, or some sort of hierarchical structure. I think people are inherently hierarchical.
The people are looking for someone to tell them what's going yes. on and what to do, and how,
and I don't think that's
inherent.
I think that's cultural, also.
Okay. I became an avid listener to the Atheist Experience podcast and YouTube show, where theists call in to make a claim for God, while Matt Dillahunty or the other co-hosts of the show would basically make the theist look like a moron, and I loved it. The one thing I was still very fascinated with was the paranormal. I no longer believed in God. I still questioned paranormal, such as spirits, ghosts, and near-death experiences. Somewhere during my late-night research, I ran across the Joe Rogan podcast. And here we go, Joe Rogan making another guest appearance on the show. By the way, I hope that was a reference to him in your episode about Jared Wyatt when you were talking about why MMA guys were sitting around doing mushrooms. Yes, that was a reference to Joe Rogan. That was many people contacted me to ask me if I was talking about Joe Rogan, and yes. Anyway, he continues, I became fascinated by Joe Rogan's podcast and the different people he had on. One day I was watching an episode with Joe and guest Sturgill Simpson. Sturgill is a country music artist who is vocal about his drug use and makes psychedelics the theme of one of his songs called Turtles All the Way Down. In this episode, they talk about the DMT experience, which I hadn't heard about before that moment. So here's somebody who gets introduced to the whole concept of psychedelics through the Joe Rogan podcast, which the episode we were just talking about.
Yeah, we were talking about Sturgill last week.
Sturgill Simpson, mm-hmm. The last. Who? So, are we finding ourselves in this story yet? Okay. So.
Are we in the synchronicity hole? Is that what you called
yeah,
it?
Yeah, the synchronicity hole, yeah. So, after hearing about that on the Joe Rogan podcast, I then do more research on DMT, and I'm completely blown away about how this entire time people have been talking about near-death experiences, that there is a drug out there that will give you exactly what these people are describing. So, in my mind, that means it's all chemical. It had to be that these experiences are just chemically induced. Soon after this, I found myself reading books about astrotheology, shamanism, Amanita muscaria, and religion and the like. It wasn't until 2 years later when I finally had my first psychedelic experience. Wow. Was it 2 years ago that Sturgill Simpson was on the Joe Rogan podcast?
He was on just recently, and then he was on probably 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay, so this would have been not the most recent Sturgill Simpson.
It was the previous one.
It was
one,
the previous
sure.
one. Okay, yeah. So I was trying to piece this together, and I was confused when I said it was 2 years ago. But yes, I guess there was a previous.
He's not a time traveler after all.
How disappointing.
The spring of 2017 is when I met my fiancé. On our second date, after we came back to her house at dinner, I decided to bring up the topic of DMT. She let me ramble about it for at least an hour and show her videos I had saved on YouTube about people having such common experiences. I couldn't believe she let me drone on about this shit for what seemed like hours. I eventually asked her to marry me. That's so sweet. So, finally, after that not-so-brief summary of my life, I can get into my psychedelic journey. Here we go. Wow, this is a long one. In July of 2018, a friend of mine had acquired some psychedelic mushrooms. He had taken a few caps at a Dave Matthews Band and Widespread Panic concerts, but he wasn't necessarily familiar with psilocybin. He knew how interested I was in psychedelics, and he decided to gift me nearly 10 grams of magic mushrooms. Now, I hadn't the first clue on dosage and what to expect when taking them, so I asked around. The best first-hand advice I got was, give your girlfriend 2 or 3 grams, then take the rest and go to space.
So, one thing I want to comment on here is how happy I am when he's doing all the research.
Yeah. he jumped into astrotheology,
so
shamanism.
So, he did seem to make a bad click at some point when he got into the, like, Amanitas and astro, whatever. That seems like it was a hard right turn that maybe was not the right click.
It seemed like he was getting it all together. Yeah. Like, oh, it's all drug-induced.
Yes,
near-death experiences are all chemical.
Keep
I'm gonna study this. But instead of studying chemistry or neuroscience, he goes into
hard
right. Yes.
He did do some research, which is great. But then he gets the drugs, and his friend says, yeah, just give some to your girlfriend and eat the rest. Like, could you maybe arrow it? Like, just a little more research about dosage maybe would be good.
There's some definite dose problems in this story,
yeah,
that we'll talk about later. But what about this idea of going to space? Is this something that you've heard? Do people talk about, I'm going to eat mushrooms and go to space?
I don't know, go to space. I like to say talk to God because I think that's funny.
I once heard a guy in an ayahuasca ceremony say, I'm going to drink a full cup and turn into a condor and fly into the Milky Way.
Was that guy you?
And that little boy was me.
That never happened to me in a full cup.
Okay. Being a bit hesitant on taking that many mushrooms, I decided to start slow. My fiancé and I started our trip with a lighthearted movie so we would be in a happy mood. She picked out the Disney movie Moana. I took 5 grams from a bag and parted it out for the both of us. Is that funny?
Moana? I thought a small dose was 5 grams. Okay, if they're going to part 2.5 each, I think, I mean, that's for your first trip maybe a bit, but I thought he was going to take 5 for himself.
Okay, yeah, they split it. That's cool.
I took maybe 3 to 3.5 grams for myself and gave her the rest. Near the end of the movie is when our trip started to take effect, color started to change, and music sounded different. This being the first time we had tripped, we were laughing our asses off and just really enjoying it. We must have laid on the floor listening to music for maybe an hour or so until I decided it'd be a great idea that we take the rest of the bag of mushrooms.
That was a mistake.
I figured we wouldn't find the time too often to take psychedelics. So we should just take the rest of them and go to space, he says again. And I still don't understand this go to space thing, but
it's
maybe
a regional,
this is maybe it
Illinois
is a,
thing.
Maybe it is a regional thing. So once again, I took the rest of the bag and ate 3 grams or so and gave my girlfriend another 2. Between the two of us, we had eaten 10 grams of dried magic mushrooms on our first trip. It wasn't too long after this when objects started to breathe. And I started to experience the presence of an entity. Now, I don't want you to think this is the trip I wrote you about, because it's the exact opposite, but I need to explain this one to continue. During this trip, I thought I felt the presence of multiple entities speaking to me through music, body sensations, and emotions. They were all a bit different, but they all seemed to be an extension of God. At one point, I saw Hindu entities, which I would now say was Shiva and Kali, and the elephant figure Ganesh. Before this trip, I had very little knowledge of Hindu culture or beliefs. However, I am rational enough to consider that the fact every time I moved my arms, it looked like I had multiple arms because of the trails, that this may have made me think of a Shiva figurine that I had seen somewhere before. Again, this is like, can we picture archetypes in our head if we've never seen those archetypes before? And the rational part of you says, I must have seen this before somewhere. Otherwise, how did this get in my head?
Right.
Where is this coming from?
Right.
Unless it's coming from a collective unconscious.
Makes me wonder what music they were listening to, too.
Mm.
Could be, yeah.
You know, I mean, if it was Indian classical music, that could definitely have been some sort of a trigger, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I would totally listen to Indian classical music and trip and go to space.
Definitely go to space with Captain Kirk.
With Shiva. Captain Kirk. Party on.
I think we have the name of our band. At the apex of this trip, I lost all sense of myself. There was no good, no bad. Everything just was. I then had memories of dying on the cross and was convinced that I was God. But so was everyone and everything. Once I started to come down from the trip, I had visions that I was being thrown out of the Garden of Eden back into the world of duality and opposites. My fiancé's trip was much different, but it was deeply profound and enjoyable as well. I told her that I learned from my trip that God was playing a video game as every character, but he doesn't remember being God. It wasn't until about a month later when I read in a book on Zen Buddhism by Alan Watts that he says the Hindus describe God as playing hide-and-seek with himself, and that the goal is to find the Atman inside your false self. This discovery had a deep impact on me, considering I thought I had no longer believed in the idea of God, and here I was having a revelation in a drug-induced trip about the same thing Hindus have been talking about for thousands of years. Now, this reminds me of the connection that Carl Jung makes with his patient in the Mithras Liturgy. How are these things connected? God is playing hide-and-seek with himself in a video game, right? And then he hears that same line repeated to him in a book by Alan Watts. So, connections, yeah. Right? Connections are coming together. I didn't trip again for 7 months. Honestly, I didn't think I needed to trip ever again. I thought I had achieved the ultimate enlightenment and just needed to unpack this trip for a very long time, which I did.
Gold stars.
Yeah, I agree.
My research somehow brought me to Dr. Jordan Peterson's biblical series on YouTube.
It's good.
Which enticed me to read A Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell, making another appearance on the podcast. I would love to hear your thoughts about that book and psychedelics. It seems to me that a psychedelic trip is eerily like a hero's journey or monomyth. I was able to recount a lot of my trip and match it to the specific part of the journey. It seems to me that this is why we love stories and movies so much. It is because for some reason this monomyth is ingrained in our psyche. Perhaps it is just a fantastical allegory for everyday life. That's some deep thoughts going on in here. I mean, this person is definitely a very self-reflective person.
Yeah.
Okay, so right turn coming.
Oh, boy.
February 29, I had started my path into the Freemasons.
Wait a minute, what?
Here we go. I had reconnected with a childhood friend who was very involved in Freemasonry. And who also happens to sell psychedelics.
Perfect.
I'd now found mushrooms in my life again without looking for them. By the time I tripped a second time, I'd listened to many people in the psychedelic community, and I had heard about the infamous Terence McKenna 5 grams and silent darkness trips multiple times, and decided that's what I would do. I'll spare you most of the details about this trip. It did border on the line of good and bad throughout the entire trip. It made me appreciate the bad to appreciate the good. One thing I would like to mention is that the main image I kept seeing in this trip was snakes. My entire visual field was enveloped by these semi-transparent, beautifully colored snakes that twisted around each other just like a caduceus or staff of Hermes. It wasn't until later that I discovered this image is an occult symbol representing opposites and the Kundalini awakening. So here is 2 times I've seen something in a trip that I was ignorant about, but has massive meaning in the occult and psychedelic world.
I'll take quick umbrage with that point, because the Kundalini symbology is fairly sophisticated, and it's not just because you saw snakes doesn't mean that you saw Kundalini imagery. You know what I mean? It's
it does if you're high, though.
It's like saying it does. Okay, I'll concede to that. But it's like saying that you saw the cover of a book and then you don't have to actually read the book because you saw the cover of it. Does this make sense?
Yeah, but I think the key here is the connections, making the connections. Snakes, Caduceus, Garden of Eden, Kundalini, right? What else is a snake? You know, all of these things start pouring on top of each other in the artifice of meaning, right? They sort of mimic meaning, all of these connections, these isomorphic connections that you make between snake symbology. But is there really any meaning there?
It's just exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just fun. Yeah. I have a theory about what those snakes are, by the way. I've seen, have you, do you see snakes? Do you see translucent snakes overlaid over everything?
Does any, translucent anybody snake. Seen I, see, I guess I've seen like little snaky snakes before. One time, I like snakes, though.
One time I was hiking up a trail, and I was looking down, and there was leaves on the ground, and then the leaves started to turn into birds. And then I realized that it wasn't birds, but it was scales on the back of a snake. And I was walking up a giant, like, python or giant snake. That's the only time I think I've ever seen a snake.
Sounds beautiful.
Wow. Wow.
That's cool, man.
we're all blown away. Did you, like, surf the snake into the...
I did. It only lasted maybe 5-10 seconds. But I was, like, for those 5 or 10 seconds, my jaw literally dropped open. I was like, I'm on a snake!
Continuing. Now, I will admit that I am not ignorant to the fact that there is some weird occult and mystical symbolism tied to Freemasonry, not to mention conspiracy theories and notions that they are perhaps Luciferian or Gnostic. But by my third trip, I had just become initiated as a first-degree Mason. I decided to trip alone again while listening to a playlist I found created by the great folks at Johns Hopkins to induce mystical experience. It's basically 10 hours or so of classical music with religious undertones.
Boring.
Have we heard? I haven't heard the Johns Hopkins playlist. Has anybody heard?
No, nor have I.
Don't bother.
No Pink Floyd on it?
No Pink Floyd.
If you don't have the End by the Doors.
Right. This is the end.
I'm out. That's all I'm going to say.
During this trip, I was trapped between heaven and hell for hours. It started with Baphomet, or the devil, coming out of the ceiling when I closed my eyes.
Yes.
Hilla's making devil horns over here. It was like he was trying to force himself into my head. I then saw Jesus manifest in a curtain, and he had a sinister look on his face. Jesus is like, hey, what's up?
Yeah.
And he eventually morphed into the devil, who looked at me like he wanted to help me. I would then continue to be caught up in a repetitive cycle where I would be in hell seeing people getting ripped apart and feeling like shit for my sins, and then I would be in heaven and be forgiven, and these souls would start praising God for his mercy and grace. The music I was listening to undoubtedly induced this state.
Interesting. I feel a little bit skeptical of that.
About the music?
Yeah, just because of the...
There's a lot of stuff going on in his own psyche. Yeah, I know that the music was the only trigger that caused him to see heaven and hell, but that I can definitely see how classical music can lead to...
Be
it's supposed to be a mystical experience.
Yeah,
and if your only context for mysticism is Christian
good
religion,
then
that's a mystical experience.
So I just want to say this really, really quickly too. Like, if anybody out there identifies with these visions, I don't think any one of the three of us here is trying to make fun of your experience. And I think that this is really indicative of some real, real heavy, heavy programming. And I personally have never had an experience with devils or angels or heaven and hell, but I've done basically everything in my power to escape that ontology. It just it's never resonated with me, and I've just never participated in it. But I just think that if you look at this guy's past, he's just you're programmed to experience this, and then all of a sudden you're giving your mind license to explore some of these parameters, and unfortunately you found them. You know, you found what you were looking for. And I think that that's a saying out there someplace, that you're much more likely to find what you're looking for. And you found it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to belittle anybody's personal beliefs. I was raised vaguely religious. I mean, Christian. And I have seen Christian iconography, demons, devils. But I never really internalized my faith. Like, people would tell me that, you know, Christ died for my sins. And I'd be like, I don't think he did.
Like, that doesn't, what do you mean by that?
That doesn't sound right to me. Is what I basically my whole relationship with religion was, that doesn't really sound right to me. So when I would see demons or devils in my trips, I would just be like, awesome.
Totally.
I would just be like, this is some really gnarly shit going on, man. What the heck? Okay. About 1 month later, my Freemason friend gave me some LSD as a gift. He gives me a piece of paper or cardboard that he had drawn an eternity symbol on, and told me to split it with my fiancé because it was about 3 hits. I decided one evening to try it. I took half the piece of paper and was waiting for my fiancé to get home. She told me that she had too much stuff to do the next day and she didn't want to be up tripping all night, so she declined. About 2 hours after watching TV and waiting for the trip to kick in, I started to get the sensation, and I quickly decided to take the other half of the paper. Is this a pattern that we're seeing here?
Yeah.
We take a dose and then wait, and then just as it's starting to come on, we double it.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe a mistake.
I agree.
Within 20 minutes of feeling the first sensations, I was tripping hard. The feeling and visuals of the LSD was much different than that of the mushrooms. This time I found myself surrounded by demons and horned beings and dark occult entities for the entire trip. However, I was not frightened. I was seeing satanic imagery, 666 pentagrams, violent imagery, and this weird birdman figure. I also developed some sort of fetish during this trip with blood and horror movies. After this trip is when I really started thinking about entities. I assumed these things I was seeing were manifestations of my psyche, but I couldn't be certain. It's an interesting statement, right? I thought these things that I was seeing were manifestations of my psyche, but I couldn't be certain. It's because it's a lack of understanding of what the boundaries of the world are.
Yeah, it's this borderline psychosis at that point.
Yeah, I feel like there may be a little bit of boundary getting lost here. This led me to purchase Carl Jung's book, The Collective Unconscious, so I could see if I could gather some answers from there. It would also sit on my shelf for many months until after my next trip.
Just like any good book.
I did, however, do some research on this birdman figure I kept seeing. Right off the bat, I came across a figure of a symbol of a human body, a head of a rooster, and the legs of what were two snakes that looked oddly familiar to my trip symbol. This figure was called Abraxas. Apparently, it was also on the seal and coin of the Knights of the Templars, and it was also said that this is one of the gods that they were worshipping. Is his Freemason drug dealer, like whammying him? I mean, this is what I was thinking when I was like, it's like his Freemason friend is like giving him drugs and filling his head with his ideas. And
his friend is probably in the same bad spot he is. Just like well, a lifetime we're gonna, of weird programming.
We're gonna get to that. Now, I know what you're probably thinking. Of course.
Well.
Of course this dude had a bad trip. Listen to all this crazy shit he's been thinking about and tripping about, not to mention his repressed trauma that's going to inevitably boil up to the surface. But I didn't think a bad trip was likely. Even though my mind was busy with all this stuff, I still held on to the idea that these were all just crazy coincidences, and perhaps I was just making connections that didn't need to be made. But I couldn't help myself. Going down the rabbit hole was just too much fucking fun to pass up. So, in late June of 2019, I consumed 3.5 grams of dried penis envy. I was told these mushrooms were potent, maybe twice the strength of regular cubensis mushrooms, so I decided 3.5 grams would be enough to induce a mystical experience. I decided once again to trip alone in the dark. However, this time my fiancé was in the house. I would be in the extra room upstairs. That was basically my designated tripping room. Do you guys all have a designated tripping room?
No.
I have known people who had designated tripping rooms in their house. It's not a common thing. So maybe 20 minutes after dosing, I got a call from my Freemason friend and drug dealer. He just wanted to call and chat, and he told me to have a nice trip. It's worth stating that he had started to have some delusional thinking weeks before this and told me he was worried about me finishing my degree work with the Masons and taking my last obligation. Each ritual you swear on a Bible and take an oath. He was sincerely worried that perhaps on this third oath it was going to seal the fate of my soul and perhaps doom me for eternity. I told him he was talking crazy and didn't think much of it.
I would like to recommend that you turn your phone off.
Yeah, if you're tripping, get your phone out of there.
Just no with the screens.
So wait a minute. Did we all understand that correctly, that his friend just put that program in his head like 20 minutes after he ate 3.5 grams of penis envy?
I feel
it seems like a mindset situation.
I'm not exactly sure.
Acute.
I haven't followed up on this particular thread of the conversation about the Freemason friend, but it seems like the Freemason friend is doing a lot of programming here.
Yeah.
Was it coincidence that he just called that day when his friend was starting to trip, or did he know that he was tripping that night and called him to say, "Hey, dude, have you taken it yet?"
Yeah, almost certainly. If I had a relationship like that, I would tell my friend that I was going to trip. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, that seems pretty common. So I would imagine his friend probably knew, right?
Yeah.
So his friend calls and is like you said, James, have you taken it yet? Oh, you've taken it. Let me tell you that your soul's damned. who in their right mind would ever tell anyone that, even like if they were sober? It's such a bizarre thing to say.
But he's the Freemason friend. They're both in the Freemasons together, right?
Well, yes.
So his friend is worried that he's joining the same thing that the Freemason friend is doing, and he's worried about his soul. I'm just confused that he's concerned because they're both doing the same thing.
Well, he's concerned that if his friend is going to take this, is going to swear this third oath and mm-hmm. become like a full Mason, that he has to be pure of heart or something and do it without reservation. Otherwise, he accidentally damns himself to hell, I guess, for lying on his Bible oath.
They're both totally spun out. I think it's both of them.
You have such a sad look.
I think it's really sad.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. About an hour into my trip, I decided that I didn't take enough to induce a mystical journey.
Never take enough.
So I decided to take another gram or so. This is for following the pattern here of like dosing and then doubling the dose halfway through. I basically became so relaxed during this trip that I would start to fall asleep. As I would doze off, I would enter what seemed to be a deeper and more intense trip. So, the idea I was getting from this trip was that when we sleep, we're basically tripping. And when we trip, we're just dreaming while awake. So I journeyed into my mind and kept relaxing to the point of falling asleep, and each time I did this, I got deeper and deeper. My body had never felt so relaxed on mushrooms before. I was in complete sleep paralysis. My visions got very sinister and horror movie-like, but I knew it was all mental and wasn't the least bit disturbed. After my previous trips, this seemed to be the norm for me now, and I knew I had to endure the gross stuff to eventually get to the more delightful experience. I remember every now and then opening my eyes and looking over to my windows, which had some moonlight peeking through. The light was the only thing I could see in the room. Each time I'd see the window, I would wonder if I was dreaming or if it was real. Now that's I thought that was a very poetic paragraph. It was one of the reasons why I love this note so much, is because this person is a very evocative writer. I mean, it's not only is it hard to remember what goes on a trip sometimes, it's really hard to recall these little moments, these little vignettes. That's like, this is exactly what I felt was happening. And I think this person has really done a good job at capturing that. At one point in this trip, I imagined that I could see the timeline of my life and could maybe interact with it somehow. Has anyone done this?
I think I have.
Yeah, I've definitely done this.
Not just in a dream.
No.
No.
Okay. I thought that if I could maybe slip some kind of clue to myself from the space I was in into my material universe, I could prove to myself that this was indeed real. So I decided I would try to manifest some type of money into my bank account or something good that would happen to me. There you go. American. So this is when shit starts getting bad, he writes. I believe it all started with this one thought. I've watched enough horror movies about demons and witchcraft to know that if you make some type of deal or spell to manifest some type of selfish gain, you must sacrifice something material. Everything comes with a price. So this thought came and went in an instant, but suddenly manifested into a monster. I was quickly overcome with the presence of a dark, sinister entity that was telling me that I shouldn't have tried to alter anything, and I wasn't allowed to do those things. It was then obvious that this thing wanted to punish me for it, and it wanted the life of my son.
Jeez.
This thing was telling me that it was going to go after my son and my fiancé for what I did. I felt the feeling of impending doom and knew that if something bad happened, it would be because of me.
Can you imagine if all of the manifest your reality love and lighters like suddenly had to pay for what they've been trying to manifest?
Like the creative visualization people who are trying to
just manifest what you need and everything will, it's all good.
And then the
it's
demon
all love and
will
light.
Come and steal your child. Yeah. That's a good, maybe a good movie. Screenwriter guy wants to be a screenwriter. Here we go. This is it.
Yeah, it's a good point.
I got up and turned the lights on. I heard my fiance come upstairs while she was doing some stuff around the house, and I asked her if she was okay. My son was at a friend's house staying the night, and it took everything I had not to call his friend's parents to ask to hear my son's voice. I knew I was just going crazy. The fear momentarily started to pass, and then my fiancé came into the room to ask me what was wrong. I was then overcome with the feeling of shame. Shame that if something happens to them, it will be my fault. And suddenly this thing wasn't some demon looking for a life, it was God himself. I was then thrown into the spiraling cascade of realities, folding over on themselves for eternity. Everything was suddenly meaningless, and all of reality, as I knew it, was one big fucking joke to keep me occupied, because I was a prisoner, and this thing, or God, was keeping me trapped, so I couldn't achieve godlike status. Okay, so he's trapped in a conspiracy theory now, although it's a good one.
You're a
God,
fan.
God is keeping us all trapped here. I think that's true. I think that's pretty close to what's going on. The only way I can describe what I was experiencing is to compare it to looking into a mirror with another mirror, and you get an infinite number of reflections. That's basically what it looked like in my trip. I didn't know what was real and what was fake. I thought maybe I had gone insane and would be stuck like this forever. Or perhaps I was in hell and this was God fucking with me to teach me a lesson. Also, I thought I was being dominated and incapacitated so that I would be unable to protect the ones I love while this thing tried to kill them. Yikes. While all these thoughts were going through my head, I also had the idea that I was caught up in the ultimate conspiracy. You mentioned in your podcast that some people feel as if they're caught up in the ultimate archetypal battle of good and evil. Well, I was definitely there. And I thought that the entire Bible was one big fucking clue to give me a heads up about this exact moment in my life. Now, I've definitely been there. I felt that for sure. That all the mythology and all the religion that I've ever studied was to give me a clue to what I should do in this moment right now while I'm high on drugs. I've definitely felt that same thing.
I've had something similar to that, but I don't think it was... You know, I've had instances where I thought that events, past events, had kind of colluded me to get me to the moment in this experience, but never... But, I just don't identify at all with religion, so it just makes sense.
But this whole idea of past events pushing you into a moment...
Yeah, well, it's pulling you towards the eschaton, I believe. Yeah.
It's eschaton, not eschaton. I don't know. We're not doing this again. Okay, returning to the letter. The entity wanted to kill my son, and that would be the only way I would escape this prison. But I kept refusing. This became the ultimate Abraham and Isaac sacrificial story for me. And I swore I then remembered every reference to sacrifice in the Bible, and it suddenly all made perfect sense to me. I couldn't escape this prison because I wasn't willing to sacrifice my son. So after fighting back and forth with this entity, it showed itself to me visually. I saw what would be comparable to the Eye of Sauron from the Lord of the Rings. It was this burning mandala image that looked very satanic in nature. It had the classic goat-horned devil within the image, and it showed me that in order to save my son and for me to get out of hell, I would have to worship this thing, which was the Christian God, for as long as I lived, and would have to commit my life to church and the Lord. So God is the burning eye of Sauron with the devil goat horns flashing you the high five sign.
I think that's relevant to mention. I keep thinking, coming back to when he says, you know, I've seen enough horror movies about witchcraft and demons to know.
Good point.
You've seen enough movies about horror, about witchcraft and demons. Like, that's a period. Like, you've seen to construct an entire...
Are you saying you've seen enough, you've seen too many?
Yeah. Like, it's, look what it is, how it's influenced his conscious experience or subconscious experience even. And this reference to like, oh, I saw the demon and it was like this thing from a movie that I watched.
Going back to the TV discussion.
Yeah.
Got to be careful what you let in. It's going to, because it will echo around in there. That's something that I've learned. So this is the sad part. It's worth noting that I probably considered putting a gun in my mouth to end this all at least a dozen times while this was going on, but I didn't want to take the chance of it being real and actually killing myself, which, obviously, I wouldn't have woken up with a bullet to the brain. My fiancé noticed that I was feverishly hot and suggested that she help me in the shower. I couldn't form a complete sentence to explain to her what was happening. I just kept repeating bullshit like, we're not good enough, and it's all my fault, over and over and over, and telling her I was sorry and that I was going to be crazy forever.
I think a cold shower might have been a good idea.
Well, at this point, he's poisoned. He's poisoned himself, right? Yeah. He's obviously overdosed. His fever is going up. His blood pressure is probably through the roof. I constantly tell people that psychedelics are basically voluntarily poisoning yourself. When you take too much, it becomes obvious. Oh, I feel like I'm dying. I'm sick. I need to. I'm at death's door. Somebody help me.
Making pacts with the devil.
Right. Even just these things, like from psychological effect alone, like, you know, you raise your heart rate. You're very scared. He thinks he's dealing with demons.
Right.
I'm not surprised that he's cooking.
So my fiance managed to get me in the shower and cool me off. I don't know how long we were in the shower for, but eventually I started getting my shit together, and in no religious tone at all, I said, Jesus Christ, 3 times. I wasn't praying or trying to invoke Christ or anything, but as soon as I said it, I felt this peace come over me, and the fear went away, and it was clear to me in that moment, Christ had saved me by dying for me. Now, this isn't what I'm really implying, but during my trip, that was the gospel truth. I just knew that all these stories about sacrifice and all that shit was about me in this situation, right now, and that I was trapped in that prison by the love of my son, but somehow the real God loved us so much, he sent his son Jesus to die to make that sacrifice to the God so that I wouldn't have to. Yes, I know this is all fucking insane. You're right. It's God-man psychosis. He wrote God-man, but I read it goddamn psychosis. God-man psychosis. The weeks following this trip, I tried to maintain my sense of normal as well as I could, but I kept thinking about all the shit that happened and kept questioning what was real and what wasn't. I constantly had a weird feeling in my stomach and started having real anxiety issues and would have small panic attacks. I did mention earlier that I had anxiety after combat, but that had been years ago, and I had one panic attack years before, which was brought on by a ton of stress. It resulted in me getting admitted into the hospital because I thought I was having a heart attack. Have either of you ever had a panic attack?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They can feel like you're having a heart attack.
Show. Yeah.
I actually had an ambulance called because I thought I was having a heart attack.
Classic. Sorry.
Was this post-psychedelic experimentation? Was this after? I mean, not like directly related to a trip, but...
I was actually withdrawing from alcohol. Oh, so it was an acute panic attack probably, with withdrawal symptoms.
Right. Makes sense.
I just want to put a sidebar in. I stopped having panic attacks after using psychedelics.
Oh, good for you.
Thank you.
It worked.
It worked for me.
The few weeks following this trip, I was sure that a big panic attack would happen again. Fortunately, it did not. This is when I finally decided to crack open Carl Jung's The Archetypes and the Collective.
Dusted that book off.
It's like every time we feel like, oh, you're on the road back to normal. Whoops, here we go again. I found this book to be helpful in identifying the parts of my psyche that were manifesting these entities, and it made total sense. I learned about the anima animus, the shadow, and all the archetypes we produce depending on how we were raised and how healthy our lives and relationships are. Fucking super. I'm back on the rationality train again, or so I think. If I was acting rational, I would have dropped the psychedelics right then and there and stopped filling my head with all the nonsense I was consuming. But what's the fun in that? So after a month of thinking about the last trip, I decide that I'm going to confront this demon again and make it go away. By what? By tripping on 4 grams of mushrooms again. Pretty good idea. I told my fiance my plan, and I told her, I heard they tell patients at Johns Hopkins that if you see a snake, jump into its mouth. And that's what I aim to do if I see this thing again. Is this a piece of advice anybody's ever heard?
I love this advice.
You like it?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, I like the advice, but nonetheless, like, I've never heard it. If you see a snake, jump in its mouth.
Well, you know, like, go into it.
The only way out is through?
Yeah, that.
Early on in my tripping, when I would, like, see entities or, like, malevolent creatures, I developed the come at me, bro strategy. Which was like, you want some of this? Come at me. And that would usually make them disappear because it was, you know, it was just vocalizing my anxiety sort of made them disappear.
So I embrace them and fill them full of love.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Do you spoon them?
Do you do that with actual human beings that you know?
Nope, I don't like to touch people.
Ha ha ha!
entities. We're all good. Yeah. Oh, good. That was a good one. Oh boy. Okay, where we go? Okay, I'm gonna jump in the snake's mouth if I see it again. So once I finally take the mushrooms and peek, I do see this entity again, but this time it looks different. It is apparent that it is in control of all matter, and all in all, it is evil. But this time it looks like the Birdman I saw on my LSD trip. Abraxas? Whatever. I didn't mull it over too much. I lie on the floor while this almost holographic image hovered over me, and I told it to eat me. It suddenly dissolved. My trip then got fun and lighthearted, and I listened to Fish for 2 hours, and it was amazing.
Dude, he was really high.
So high to like Fish.
Oh, Fish is fine. I mean, a lot of music that sort of sucks is then incredibly amazing. Yeah. It's really then totally amazing when you listen to it on psychedelics. I mean, that's kind of what I came to the conclusion about the Grateful Dead. It's like, I didn't really like their music. I just like being high and listening to their music.
Yeah. I agree.
So the advice worked.
It seems like the advice worked.
At this time. Fish. But then?
Then my phone died, which was how I was playing my music. Suddenly things got dark again. I became depressed and shameful, and the entity was back. I was stuck with suicidal thoughts, and I was worried that if I didn't do something to fix myself, I was going to kill myself or worse, possibly hurt my fiancé, who was sleeping in our bedroom.
That's heavy duty.
Mm-hmm.
I went downstairs and took a cold shower, and I even tried to pray to Jesus to maybe reproduce the same healing effect his name had in my last trip, but that seemed to serve no purpose. This entity basically just kept telling me that I'm a piece of shit and I should kill myself because I'm scum. But if I do, then I'll go to hell, and I'm probably going anyway because I'm a piece of shit, so I might as well suck a shotgun and get it over with. Does anybody identify with this part of the trip?
I've spiraled pretty dark.
Yeah.
Where I was like, you're a piece of shit. Yeah, your life is a failure. Blah, 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 blah. So I could see that. I could see that happening.
Well, I've definitely had this happen to me too. And I want to reiterate that suicidal ideation is generally a response to some kind of serotonin imbalance. And psychedelics can definitely mess with your serotonin balance. And definitely towards the end of a trip, after you've come through the peak and you're coming down, there can be, like you said, we talked about this last time, you get the lonelies or something that, where you're just completely empty and adrift and you're wondering, what the hell are you even doing? And then it becomes a spiral, right? Yeah. Yeah. This is the hard one. I used to call this the dark night of the soul because you would just have to sit there and clench your teeth and get through it and try to convince yourself that you're not a piece of shit, even though the voices in your head are telling you that you are. It's a tough one. I got out of the shower, dried off, and found my way to the couch and turned on The Office, the television show. What a great show about nothing. Nothing that could really induce any weird thoughts about killing myself or any type of occultism. Good thing it was the American Office and not the British Office. That's all I'm saying. I lay in the fetal position like a little bitch for another hour or so, holding on to a blanket like I was a child until finally the suicidal thoughts went away.
I've combated it just by curling up in the fetal position and just crying.
Well, that's
sobbing,
it. That's
sobbing
it.
Sobbing and you're sobbing. Just giving over to just giving over completely to the emotive experience of it and just being essentially just crying.
But I would call that a complete emotional crash.
Oh yeah, breakdown, right? You're completely at that point in time broken, which is extremely difficult for men, you know, and extremely difficult I would imagine for a veteran as well, you know.
So what happened after that?
Usually for me, I would get relief, and at this point in time too, if I start to get the lonelies and I get depressed or sad or something like that, you know, if I have to just take a moment and cry for a little while, I'll take a moment and cry for a little while. But I'm pretty good at just like, okay, I'm going to be emotive right now. I feel the emotion, and then I'm pretty good about getting out of it. Because as you guys know, you can loop on that shit, and that'll color the next couple of hours until you come down.
And generally, I wonder about that looping with the suicidal ideation or suicidality in the trip, because there's some essence here, I think, especially with like the demons and something trying to attack and come into my head, kind of like in this letter, that remind me a lot of resistance and like I think it's notable, Ty, that you cried it out and that there was relief. Mm-hmm. And from a psychological perspective, you know, we can call that a somatic release or emotional release. It's like really like surrendering to the situation in order, surrendering to the emotion of the situation in order to process it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's been a long time since I had an experience like that myself. And I remember the last time that it happened and I thought, wow, all these thoughts I'm having in my own mind, I'm having these thoughts about myself a lot in my regular waking life. Mm-hmm. Like, I really am hard on myself. And I talked it out. And then I just stopped feeling that way.
Yeah.
So I'm a little skeptical of, like, the, like, what are the methods of dealing with that?
Right. My methods were basically, like, I would, you know, I would try to cry. I would try to have some emotional catharsis, and then it would just feel fake to me. Like, what am I doing? I'm like going through some motions here, trying to get to something. I eventually came to just think like, well, here we go again. This is this bullshit that I have to roll through until it lifts. That's the way I cope with it, is basically like thinking of it like a, like the long, uncomfortable last part of a car ride that you have. Like, you really have to go to the bathroom. Yeah, and it's just, like, horrible, and you just, you're stuck in traffic, and you just, like, have to just sit there and eat it until you can get out.
You know, it's interesting. Well, I'll just point out, for me, it was generally when I was coming up. You mentioned it was generally when you were coming down.
Yeah, definitely when I was coming down.
Yeah, I think I've only ever really kind of spiraled coming down maybe one time. Most of the time it was coming up for me. It would get really dicey. Mm-hmm. And then I would start peaking, and like in the peak you could usually get some levity because you're just so you're right. So high that there was astonishment you've starting got, to kick in, you know?
You went to space. back to the letter. Curled up like a little bitch until the suicidal thoughts went away, which is, you know, I think what a lot of people do. They crawl under the covers and pull... Get away. Go away, reality. I'm scared. So the next morning, I did some heavy thinking on this trip. And while after reading Carl Jung's book, I decided that this shadow, this entity, must be a manifestation of my father. And this is the abusive Baptist preacher father who may have sexually molested his children. He was the ultimate bad guy dressed up as a good guy. And he was probably the reason I was so interested in Gnostic stuff in the first place.
Insightful.
Well... I mean, it's a reach. A reach
that your father, who you grew up with in a you know, indoctrinating church system, would have an effect on you
what
as
I'm
an adult.
Saying is, what I'm saying is he's understood archetypes come from being raised, right? Or your trauma, your childhood trauma. So he's reaching for something, right? Mm-hmm. He's reaching back in his past saying, what could this be, right? And the first thing that comes to his mind is, oh, it's got to be dad. It's got to be my father because he's the biggest, darkest asshole figure that's in my life.
Yeah,
I think that you guys need to – that he's literally thinking that there's an entity when it's probably not an entity. It's probably some sort of legacy trauma just to kind of bond your guys' kind of two points. You know what I mean? So it's like if he thinks that he's being possessed by his father, I would say you probably want to put the brakes on that. But if you're being influenced by your father in the in that moment, absolutely, 100%.
That's what he's saying. He's saying that the seeing all of these demons, this Abraxas figure, and all of his concepts about is God good or evil come from this skewed notion he has of his father, who was supposed to be a pious man, but also exhibited very evil traits on the other side. Mm-hmm. The most cynical part of me says, no, it's all bullshit. It wasn't your father. You just saw some stuff. And if it helps you to think that maybe it was a manifestation of your father, then that's fine. But does it always need to be that cut and dried? I mean, it doesn't seem to me that it's always that cut and dried. You see some weird shit, weird stuff happens, and then you try to piece the narrative together after the fact. And the narrative that you piece together after the fact isn't necessarily what was happening in the trip. The stuff that was happening in the trip may be more along the lines of random phantasmagoria with like snippets of salient material in there.
And two, we don't even know how much PTSD he has from being in combat, you know, like
he had some, but apparently it was resolved.
Does it ever get resolved?
I believe it does get better
enough
over
to
time.
Not have anxiety attacks.
Yeah, once you control the anxiety, the PTSD can linger, but people sometimes it's much worse than others. But it sounds like that he at least had a handle on his anxiety before he started doing mushrooms again.
I think
he started taking psychedelics.
I think the only point that I'm trying to make is taking a reductionist view of what it is probably isn't the best way. I'm saying that he went through a lot of shit.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
this is probably a lot of shit that he's going through.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. And that's what I'm saying is he's reaching for something, and what he finds is his father, all of this conflict he has with his father, which is fine. Again, I just don't know that it's that cut and dried. In that moment for him, it was cut and dried. I spend the next weekend backpacking alone in the Shawnee Forest to get away and try to reconnect. On my way home, I called my dad and asked if I could talk to him. I told him about what I experienced and what I thought everything meant. And I told him that I thought this evil god was a manifestation of him in my unconscious. Now, would you be able to make that phone call?
No, and I would make a phone. I would make a slightly different phone call.
Now, I have problems with my parents, and I don't think I would be able to make this phone call with my father. My father wasn't a Baptist preacher. Now, being a preacher, he may be more inclined to listen to some sort of spiritual phantasmagoria related to a mushroom trip. That might be like interesting to a Baptist preacher. But I don't think my parents would be at all interested in hearing me talking about, oh, I saw this goat horned image and I thought it was you. I'm pretty sure my dad would just get like super defensive and be like, what the hell are you talking about?
Well, I feel like most folks, our parents' generation, if you told them that you were tripping balls on mushrooms, right? And that you had encountered demons.
Satan was there.
You thought it was them.
There.
You know, that probably would shut down the conversation.
I'm pretty sure it's
you guys. Right? So maybe we take a class on how to deal with issues with your father. You talk to your therapist about how to confront your father on how he fucked you up as a child. And then you approach it as, Dad, this is how I feel about the situation. Would you like to talk to me about it? Rather than being a, you know, accusatory. Is that a word?
Yeah.
Accusatory.
Yeah, I mean, for our families, not so much, right? But here for him, he knows his family.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt. But in a previous passage, he did say that he basically told his father off and was going to beat the shit out of him.
No, he's going to bury him.
Yeah, he's going to bury him if he ever. So he's got a kind of a weird, interesting relationship with his father. Even though he was very overbearing, he somehow does have the ability to stand up to him and say, hey, knock it off.
Yeah.
So it's.
But let's face facts. It's ultimately skirting the issue. It's a bypass to accuse your father of being a demon. It's not. Do you see what I'm saying? It's very important. It's subtle, but it's very important. Does this make sense to you guys?
This is what I was getting at when I'm saying it's he's reaching, and maybe it's not that cut and dried. I mean, he's looking for some sort of closure or some sort of connection here, and maybe his relationship with his father was the most glaring thing that he came upon. But it's not necessary. But you don't necessarily then need to make that leap and say, Dad, I think the demon in my visions is you.
I'm going to go on the record and say that you should never call someone and accuse them of being the demon in your psychedelic visions.
May I be the devil's advocate here?
Certainly. Okay, I'll ratify it. James or I can be the demon.
And if you call me to talk about it, I'm probably going to think it was about your dad.
No. Hella might internalize it and feel bad.
Oh. Not fair.
Is it possible to care too much, Hella? Hella cares. Yeah, I know. Okay, so he calls his dad and says, Dad, I think this manifestation of demon in my mind, it's you. The conversation went over surprisingly well. He's ashamed for the way he raised me.
Good.
And what he did to my sisters and everything in between. I told him I wanted to let go of the past because no matter what type of monster he was, I couldn't run away from my problems with him because he's still my father. And I am an extension of him. So I guess that's one good thing to come from all of this.
I really like this guy.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I think this person has a very good head on their shoulders. Smart, articulate, very observant and thoughtful. So Here I am, back in my rational state, hoping to never ever be in that delusional filled way of thinking again. If you've read this, I thank you so much for reading. I apologize for the length. I was very excited when you told me that I could email you, so I have been writing this all at once. I can't express my gratitude enough. Sincerely, Anonymous. I really like this guy too. Mm-hmm. It's funny that this note touches on so many of the things that we discussed, and I hadn't even read this note when I was starting to formulate mm-hmm. some of these episodes. So the lessons for me here are the problem with the doubling the dose. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's always a huge problem, especially if you're a novice. I don't know that anybody should ever do that, like in the middle of the trip, double up or re-up before you actually hit the peak.
Maybe look into why that's happening. Like, why is it that I keep doing that over and over again? Like,
yeah, I mean,
mentioned
that's
it several times, that is an but didn't even address point. It.
Yeah,
what's up, dude?
Yeah, what's up with that? It was one of my first things. And the other thing is that the whole I'm going to go into my secret tripping room and close the door. Mm. I don't know that that's healthy. I've never thought the whole do the silent darkness thing. I always thought that that's too much like digging around in your own head.
It's certainly not for like deep trauma and stuff.
It's not healthy to spend a whole lot of time digging around in there, as far as I'm concerned. I have a feeling that his experiences would be much different if he just took 2 grams of mushrooms while he was out backpacking in the Suwannee Forest. I think that that would be an amazing time that he and his fiance could share together, and they wouldn't have to worry about demons and suicide and the occult, because they've got, you know, nature there to distract them and keep them focused on their lives. But when you close yourself in your secret tripping room, sounds horrible to me. And I've done those trips, and I don't recommend it for anybody.
Well, this speaks, I feel like this speaks to something different too, that it seems to be repeated in the psychedelic community. Why is it that on your first time or your second time, even your third time, you think you can do essentially an expert level task? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, why, you know, you're the first time you go skiing, you're not going to be like, oh, I'm going to ski a double black diamond. So why would you go into the psychedelic experience going like, oh, I'm just by being, you know, able to get them, to get the substance, I'm able to cope with this experience. You know, why isn't there this, why isn't the meme, I think I heard Hilla say one time, low and slow. Why isn't there this meme of like, you know, start out with a gram. You know, start out with the gram with the lights on and just hang out.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Seriously.
Like maybe listen to some Pink Floyd or some like, you know, like something, maybe even Pink
with
Floyd is
friends.
A bit depressing.
Yeah, Pink
you know?
Floyd is very depressing. I was high on mushrooms home alone once and Welcome to the Machine came on and I almost lost it.
That's a good
Welcome
tune.
Welcome to the Machine. I'm like, no, I don't want to be in the machine.
Unwelcome.
Let me out of the machine.
So, but
that's
but
why
yeah,
I'm taking drugs.
You know, and this is and okay. So maybe this speaks to the middle America. And honestly, I can speak to it here because I've definitely had a difficult time finding like-minded people here. Right. But
in Seattle.
But yeah, I mean, if you had a couple of friends, even if your fiance is willing, I guarantee your fiance would be much more likely to repeat the experience had you done 1 gram with the lights on.
Yes.
You know, and like maybe had some cookies around.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Or baked cookies.
Or even strawberries, you know, a couple
some
strawberries.
Cool lights.
A little bit of chocolate,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Soft things.
Right.
Love it.
And the whole TV thing, the whole watching TV thing we've been over.
I'm so anti-screen. I don't even like to look at a cell phone, much less navigate it. And that, and I would say it's almost always a better idea not to answer the phone.
Turn that thing off.
You know, you're not going to be able to do anything about it for a few hours anyways.
Mm-mm. Although, like, he did mention that he was listening to music through his phone. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, that's the problem with the phone, is it becomes so part of your everyday life. You can't just turn it off and put it aside when you're,
I mean, with
but
some,
you
can. With some planning,
maybe you can just get a
stereo.
Just get a regular MP3 player or old school cassette.
Set up your computer to just play music so you don't have to touch the thing for 4 to 6 hours.
Or a little bit
of planning ahead.
Or get an instrument, you know, make
it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's great. I love playing guitar while I'm tripping.
You know, there's so many better things to do than, like, battle with Azmat.
Okay, so wrapping this up, do we think that this guy should continue writing and maybe reconsider, like, screenplay?
Oh, 100%. Or 100%. Yeah, I think it would be very cathartic.
Or even just a book or a like a novella based on this sort of experience that went through. I mean, it's already, he's already got 20 pages here.
Yes. Down. Yeah.
I would say I think it would be extremely cathartic, and let's finish the book before you repeat the experiment.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a story similar to this, or if you feel like this story resonates with something that happened to you, feel free to drop us a line here at Dose Nation, contact@dosenation.com. Maybe we'll read your letter, or maybe not. You can hope, you can cross your fingers, maybe James will pick my letter this week.
We'll lovingly tease you and try to figure you out.
And I only mention this because I still continue to get letters. I get maybe one a week from people. I just got one this morning when we sat down to record, so it just keeps going. Thank you both for being here and for taking the time to discuss this. I'm sure this listener will be very happy that we spent a lot of time digging into this. And that was another episode of Dose Nation.
Yay!
Did you see the synchronicity? Yeah.
What? You guys both said Shakespeare at the same time?
No, I wrote... I have a note right here that says Shakespeare in modern clothes. And I wrote it, and 1 minute later, Hilla said Shakespeare.
Tell me this.